This is Bloomberg Business of Sports.
COVID has been so devastating. And to see 38,000 people at Fenway Park, it was really emotional and rewarding.
On the business side, from ticket sales to jersey sales, revenues were up. Everything was really good. It was a really solid year.
I realized that at the beginning of 2019, it would be a very unique opportunity in terms of a lot of contracts being up at the same time and a lot of exciting young wrestlers being available to go out and start a wrestling company.
The country is finally deeply getting the memo about how amazing this sport is. I think the sky's the limit for MLS.
Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Scarlett Fu along with Mike Lynch, and sitting in for Michael Barr this week is the star of our Wednesday fantasy podcast, the one and only Damian Sassauer.
Damian.
Good to see you, Damian.
All right, buddy.
Hi, guys.
Good to have you aboard.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we've got a great show planned today. We got to sit down with the American Athletic Conference Commissioner, the AAC, not the ACC, the AAC Commissioner, Mike Oresko, to talk college football and conference alignment, realignment. But first, let's talk about some of the big stories of the week. And this one is a doozy, right? In a sign of the times, the LA Staples Center is shedding its old economy name. No more office supply retailer. LeBron James and his teammates will now play at the Crypto.com arena. And of course, the Clippers and the LA Kings also play in this arena as well. Mike Lynch, this was a big, big money deal here in the world of sports naming rights.
Reportedly, it's $700 million over 20 years, the biggest deal ever in the history of sports. And the name is going to transition on Christmas Day when the Lakers are playing, of all people, very popular Brooklyn Nets. So the timing is incredibly right on. And Staples Center has been the only name this arena has had since it opened in 1999. But Crypto.com is fastly emerging globally. They're involved with Formula One, UFC, Paris Saint-Germain, the Montreal Canadiens. They're coming. It's here. They're here, and it's going to become even faster and more forceful.
Yeah, Mike, I'm surprised it's not going to be called the Rivian Center or something. No, I mean, look, I mean, it's a big money deal, obviously. I mean, naming rights, it's going to go a long way. But, you know, I guess, you know, it's just amazing that it's this cryptocurrency movement that's really driving it in my eyes. It's really quite unbelievable.
You know, the thing that comes to mind is the dot-com era when a lot of stadiums were named. Up here, Gillette Stadium was originally CMGI Field. And then the .com went .bomb and CMGI, you know, fizzled, and now it Gillette took over the name. So, you know, I know a lot of people still aren't believers in cryptocurrency, but it's everywhere you turn and everywhere you look.
Well, there's real money involved here. As you mentioned, a huge, huge deal, more than $700 million over the span of two decades. And credit goes to our Jason Kelly for his reporting on this. One thing that I found interesting as well is that Crypto.com is the same company that recently spent $100 million on this global advertising campaign featuring Matt Damon. So they are splashing out left, right, and center right now. Also, another big sports story out there, Fenway Sports Group, very active right now, Lynchy.
Well, this is a major story. We have a professional baseball team owned by the Fenway Sports Group, the Boston Red Sox.
Just a small team.
Purchasing the Pittsburgh Penguins of the National Hockey League. Pittsburgh Penguins' recent value by Forbes was $845 million. And right now, Pittsburgh is ranked like 15th, right in the middle in terms of a team value. Another big part of this deal is the local TV package. Pittsburgh's games are broadcast by AT&T Sportsnet, and they have the highest ratings of any team in the National Hockey League. They have sold out 14 years, 633 straight games in Pittsburgh. People have a voracious appetite for watching the Penguins down there. But the biggest part of this deal, I'm told, is that across the street from the arena where the Penguins play, there's a parcel of land that's 28 acres, and the Pittsburgh Penguins hold the development rights to that parcel. Now, here in Boston, the Fenway Sports Group has been very active in real estate surrounding Fenway Park, and that's a big part of their package here, why they're worth more than $7 billion. And this is one of the most attractive parts of this deal for the Fenway Sports Group, is this development of real estate across the street from the arena.
Well, just so long as Mario Lemieux is still a minority owner of the franchise. No, I'm just kidding. You know, what's interesting is you're absolutely right. I mean, for me, you know, there's a lot of big money around, but John Henry's been absolutely, you know, very, very successful, you know, both in, you know, London football, you know, here in baseball, you know, and now in hockey, at, you know, kind of managing these franchises, not just managing them profitably, but managing them to championships, right? So it's going to be very interesting. And for me, you know, the Pens, yes, while they're middle of the pack right now, you know, under John Henry's leadership, I mean, I expect good things ahead for sure.
Also, well, they still have Evgeny Malkin and Sidney Crosby. Let's not forget, plenty of star power, even with Mario Lemieux. Wait, do we know if Mario Lemieux is definitely staying on?
He will be on, and he'll have a little equity stake in the acquisition.
Okay.
But the Burkle, the other owner, will not be part of it.
Ron okay, goodbye, Ron Burkle. Mario Lemieux stays on. That's the name that counts anyway.
Cashing out.
Yeah. LeBron James, by the way, has a stake in Fenway Sports Group, too, right?
He is. He now is about a 10% owner, along with Maverick Carter, which puts the Fenway Sports Group in position to pursue an NBA franchise. They've made no secret about it at all. I've talked to several members of that group, and an NBA franchise or an NFL franchise is on the horizon for them right now.
Okay, so what? They have the Boston Red Sox. Mm-hmm. They're going to, I mean, they have Liverpool, right?
Liverpool. They have Roush Racing.
Okay.
They had an infusion of capital back in March, Redbird Capital, $750 million cash, which certainly helps finance this deal here with the Pittsburgh Penguins. And remember that they also own 80% of New England Sports Network, which is a huge, huge popular which broadcasts Red Sox and Boston Bruins hockey games.
Okay, so John Henry's having a pretty good week.
He is.
Another big story that we've been following, of course, is what's going on with the Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai. So the latest here, Damien, is that Chinese state media says this tennis star sent a letter saying that she's not missing, she's not unsafe, she's actually resting at home and everything is fine. And oh, by the way, her previous allegation of sexual assault by a former senior leader in China's Communist Party, not true.
Not true. Not written by her. It's an alleged, it's an alleged farce. And so, look, I mean, we have to be clear, you know, just to put things in context, just last week was the sixth plenum of the Chinese economy, where President Xi had to basically make his pitch to basically qualify for a third term and perhaps be leader for life. And, you know, the alleged affair that was going on occurred with a Central Committee Party member. And so I think, you know, Xi and the powers that be probably did everything they can to kind of deaden this into last week's meeting. Now the plenum's over, but, you know, it's just kind of interesting. You know, it's still there. It's still something that's hanging over there, you know, markets. And certainly from, I'm an emerging market guy, you know, if that's my day job, you know, it's certainly something that adds to the risk of investing in China and looking to China as a source for capital. I mean, it's really quite unbelievable. I mean, just the way that she and the powers that be have their finger on the pulse of the story.
And Lynchy, the World Tennis Association's chairman and CEO, Steve Simon, had urged an investigation into Peng's allegations that she was sexually assaulted by Zhang Gaoli, who is the former vice premier of China. He was the number 7 official in China's Communist Party. He also, Steve Simon, told the New York Times that the group might even reconsider its operations in China if they didn't find a sufficient response, if they didn't get a sufficient response. Would tennis really pull out of China if they didn't get a sufficient response to details on this one tennis player's allegations?
Well, it would be some type of a threat. They'd have a little bit of leverage. I immediately think of the comments by Enos Kantor.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden they pulled the Celtics games from their streaming services over in China, which is a big chunk of their streaming services.
And that goes back to the Houston Rockets, right, and what happened with their general manager. I mean, look, that's exactly right. You know, China does not respond well when you have, you know, athletes speaking out of bounds. And Enos Kanter, look, outwardly, Enos Kanter is on the Boston Celtics. He's not really playing for the team right now, I think. But the point, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Mikey, but I mean, the reality is this, you know, I mean, he's kind of a firebrand. You know, he had made some disparaging comments about President Erdogan in Turkey more recently.
Yes.
And, you know, I think called him, I don't even want to say it on air, like the Hitler of our lifetime or something. Yeah. But, you know, so he's known for doing that. And the fact that they're pulling Boston Celtic games off the air in response is just unbelievable.
And not surprising at all. And Cantor has been out front of every social issue thing. When it's just the second term with the Celtics here. And when the Black Lives Matter movement was just at its peak, Enos Kanter was at the Boston Common leading a group of marchers through the city of Boston, right at the front.
It's even notable that tennis stars like Naomi Osaka have tweeted concern as well, because these athletes have skin in the game. It's not as if they don't depend on China as a market for what they do as well. And I was just looking, the WTA has 11 tournaments and also a deal to hold its tour finals in Shenzhen. So that's what's kind of at risk here if China decides to pull the WTA from the Chinese market.
And from a monetary standpoint, remember in 2019, 2020, when China pulled the NBA for the full year, that cost on paper $500 million, but we all know the number was far, far greater than that in terms of lost revenue to the league.
And the NBA is still trying to make up for that, still trying to make amends for that. Today, we are joined by the commissioner of the American Athletic Conference, Mike Oresko. It is time to talk about college football. We know that the college football playoff rankings are out. And heading into this weekend, Cincinnati is undefeated, but it's on the outside, looking in at number 5 with a pair of 9-1 teams ahead of them. We've seen this kind of story before. In 2017, UCF went undefeated and finished in the number 6 slot. So, Mike Oresko, my first question to you is, do the Cincinnati Bearcats deserve to make the playoffs?
Yeah, the answer is yes. I believe, again, if they finish undefeated, frankly, we were always hoping in our conference that a one-loss team would be seriously considered if it were worthy, but we understand the realities. But if they finish undefeated, do I think they should be in the playoff? Absolutely do. I've decided, you know, the last few weeks, and no one asked me to do this, to just take a lower-key approach. You know, I've made my points, as you know, pretty vociferously over the last several years about the playoff and how, you know, the committee views teams from the so-called G5. And by the way, we hate that label. We think that label is very destructive. And, you know, talking about the business of sports, we think that's affected, you know, everything we do. We've had outstanding teams. We've been very competitive. Should Cincinnati go undefeated and not make the playoff, this would mean we will have had 4 undefeated teams and one loss team that was very worthy in the 2015 Houston team who didn't make the playoff. And you know, that to me is you know, an unfortunate situation. Now, could it be remedied down the road with an expanded playoff? Sure. But the key for us, Scarlett, is to get rid of the G5 label. Access to the playoff is one thing, but getting rid of the G5 label, you know, this notion that we somehow play junior college football, that we don't play the real deal. For instance, Cincinnati had a close game with Tulsa. Well, do fans understand that Tulsa almost beat Oklahoma State this year at Oklahoma State, almost beat them last year as well at Oklahoma State? They had the game, you know, in hand and should have won. In addition, they went to Ohio State this year, and it was a 7-point game with roughly 4 minutes left. You know, Tulsa is not an easy team to play, and yet the expectation was that Cincinnati would somehow win that game 50-0. That's just not reality. And so, you know, it's things like that. But I'd like to take a lower key approach right now. Let's see how this plays out. Cincinnati right now is ranked 5th. You know, I think, again, teams that have lost games ahead of them, I'd like to see Cincinnati ranked ahead of them, but that's the reality. I do respect the committee. I've never used inflammatory language. I've never made it personal. I just point out nuance. I point out different aspects. You know, again, I can go through a lot of different examples. I won't do on this podcast because I really think at this point I'd rather, you know, let things play out. You know, we've got some key games coming up. Cincinnati has a very tough game with a really dangerous SMU team, really dangerous offense and pretty good defense. You know, and they beat TCU at TCU, gained 350 yards on the ground, pretty impressive performance. That'll be a tough game. In addition, ECU, East Carolina, has come on under Mike Houston, as we knew they would. They're a dangerous team, and that game is at ECU. If Cincinnati gets by SMU, and then they, if they win those, they would have to play a really resurgent Houston team. Dana Holgerson's done a fine job. They've won 9 straight. They're a very good team. They finally got ranked. They would have to play them in the championship game. So that's probably as tough a 3 games as most teams in the country, you know, will have. So we'll see what happens. I've made my points. You've all heard them about, you know, what the committee should be looking at, what it shouldn't be looking at. But I think right now, let's just see how it plays out, and we'll have more to say as we get toward the end of the season.
Yeah, Mike, it's just unbelievable that, you know, since he could be, that their eligibility could come down to the SEC championship game and the margin of victory between Alabama and Georgia. It's just unbelievable. But, you know, I mean, taking your point on the G5, P5 differentials and all that goes with that, you know, there's this new concept of the alliance that's kind of thrown a lot of this into array, right? This whole, the Pac-10, the Big Ten, and the ACC kind of, you know, trying to, you know, form this alliance and have more games between each other. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, and how does that impact some of the, you know, progress that you've made toward a 12-team college football playoff?
Yeah, I'm not sure yet how it's all going to play out. This alliance is a loose federation. We're not really necessarily sure what it means. Scheduling, well, you can do that without an alliance. You know, you can schedule big games with among conferences. We don't think it's going to have too much impact on us relative to scheduling and whom we play. We think that we'll still play ACC teams. We'll still play, you know, Big Ten teams. We don't play the Pac-12 very much. We have a 6-3 record against the Pac-12, incidentally. We played them 9 times, you know, in our, you know, history as a reinvented American Athletic Conference. And the last time, Stanford went to UCF, and UCF led 38-7 at the half. So we, you know, we don't play them quite as much. The bigger issue is, you know, that alliance group had favored an 8-team playoff. Obviously, it's 8 versus the 12-team concept, which the, as you know, the working group that was set up as part of the College Football Playoff Committee system recommended 12 teams, 6-6. We obviously favor the 6-6 concept. We think the top 6 conferences without favor, without privilege, without is a merit-based program that frankly is fair and it rewards success. You have to earn your spot. You don't just get it by virtue of your branding, by virtue of being in a particular conference. We like that. We think it's a great system. We're talking internally to our colleagues about that. We hope that ultimately that's the system that prevails. We think it's a good plan. There was some concern about health and safety, you know, the possibility that somebody could play a 17th game. There is a possibility. It's probably unlikely. We think that, you know, the minute you say that, of course, it happens. But it's probably very unlikely. And if it did happen, I think people would adjust their practice schedules. And, Mike, you played football, you know, at a high level. I played in high school. You know, you adjust your schedules, and our kids would crawl over glass to be able to play in a championship game if they ever got that opportunity, you know, that 17th game. It would be, again, I think unusual. I do think that people are coming to the conclusion that, you know, the health and safety issues will be dealt with. We talked about possibly, you know, having the first round of the playoffs be 2 weeks after the championship game to give teams a rest to spread out the season. Down the road, I think you have to take an overall look at college football and how you schedule the entire season. Do you move the season earlier and give everyone 2 byes during the season? Now, the problem with that, of course, is that means training camp opens earlier, and that causes issues in the summer with not only summer school but with, you know, time off. And coaches, usually the only time off they really get is before training camp. So, you know, there, one problem always is you solve it leads to another. That's always the case. And so you have to make trade-offs. It's that simple. You know, you just have to deal with it. So anyway, I think in the end, it's a good plan. We like it. We support it. We think it not only provides access. One of the biggest issues for us is it gets rid of that G5 label, which we think has been so harmful and has really caused us all sorts of problems. You know, we don't play junior college football. You know, our football is very good. We've had multiple teams in the top 25 over the years. We've had teams in the top 10 almost every year. We've won, you know, obviously the big bowl games. Had Cincinnati, you know, they had a 3rd-and-2 with very little time left against Georgia, and they threw a pass. But had they made that and then won the game and they outplayed Georgia that whole game, we would have had 4 wins in 6 years in the big bowl games. You know, we have really good teams. Our top teams can play with anyone. Gus Malzahn is a perfect example. He coached at Auburn when UCF beat Auburn in the Peach Bowl. That Auburn team had beaten both Georgia and Alabama. And Gus says that team could have played with anyone in the country. And I'm convinced it could have beaten anyone in the country. It's got a ton of players in the NFL now from that team. In addition, the UCF team the following year, until Mackenzie Milton got hurt, the Houston team in 15, which beat Florida State by two touchdowns in the Peach Bowl. Florida State was in the top 10 at the time. Jimbo Fisher was the coach. Cincinnati's team last year, which took Georgia to the limit, should have won the game. And then this year, another outstanding Cincinnati team, which, by the way, did something pretty remarkable. They went to Notre Dame, and they ended Notre Dame's 26-game home winning streak. I mean, think about that. 26 home wins. That's pretty impressive. It's a hard place to win at. And Cincinnati not only won, they dominated the game. So we think, again, we play really good football. The question now becomes, what kind of playoff system going forward? We'd like to get rid of the G5 label. Let's make it all FBS. That's the fairest system. Now, some FBS conferences are probably created more equal than others. Let's face it, there's some that have more resources, some that typically have outstanding teams. Well, that's fine. If you've earned it, I have no issue with that at all. We're not going to be the Big Ten or the SEC. We understand that. But we've been competitive with the other conferences pretty much regularly. And some years we're competitive with the Big Ten and the SEC. So all we're looking for is opportunity. And I think it's really important because you know how important branding is. We all do. Branding is critical, and something that we have to be it's a larger issue than simply access to a playoff.
Mike, I would think that the expansion to a 12-team playoff would benefit your conference and other conferences as well. Notice how I didn't use that moniker that you want to get rid of. But I look right at the NCAA basketball tournament. When it expanded, it gave teams like Butler a chance to reach the Final Four, Loyola Chicago, George Mason. When you were restricted with a 32-team, it was basically what you have now in college football, league champions and just some of the ACC teams and the Pac-12 teams. But I think this would give your conference and other conferences an opportunity, a 12-team playoff.
Mike, it would. And it's interesting. As Cinderellas have not been typical in college football. It's a different sport. A very famous basketball coach once said, I heard him say it, with two good guards, I can get to the Final Four, but football's a corporation, right. and it is, it's different. But could there be Cinderella stories in football? Absolutely. Look at us the last several years. Now, I don't really think we're in that category anymore because we're just pretty good. Our conference is very good. But look at Coastal Carolina this past, a year ago. Look at some of the other teams. Look at some of those Boise teams from the old days. It can happen, but it hasn't been allowed to happen. And I think it would be good. It would be refreshing for the sport. I think we've seen ratings struggle. Now, COVID was a definite factor last year in ratings. But I think there's less interest when the same teams continue to be, in the playoff. And I think the tournament has tremendous charm because of that, the early rounds, all the upsets. Now, granted, basketball is a different sport. We all understand that. But this system, if you had a 6-6 system, if a team didn't make it, it probably didn't necessarily deserve to be there. This gives you 6 at-larges, which is, roughly, obviously you have 6 automatics because and we hope the plan that ultimately is adopted is the one proposed by the working group, which is the top 6 conference champions, period, whoever the committee ranks. And as the committee has tended to really emphasize strength of schedule. That's helped the P5 to some degree, although I think our strength of schedule has been underestimated for a number of years. But be that as it may, it's a good system. The system in the NCAA is 32 conferences. All 32 Division I conferences get an automatic bid, and then you have 36 at-larges. Well, this is very similar, 6-6. It's rough, it's very similar to the roughly half that you have in the NCAA. And it provides more access. And the main thing is it doesn't differentiate anymore between, the so-called P5 and G5. Now, the media may still use that term. I hope eventually, though, it would go away if it were just 10 FBS conferences competing for those slots. I mean, the Sun Belt's had some pretty good teams. We've dominated, the so-called G5 the last, 8 years or so, 9 years. If you go back to 13, which wasn't, playoff didn't start till 14, we had, UCF back in 13 that won the Fiesta Bowl, beat a Baylor team that was in the top 5 in the country. So we've been there, and we've you know, we've made our mark, but some of these other conferences could do it as well. Hmm. And the other last thing I'll mention is things change. You know, nothing stays the same. There's been realignment already. You know, it's changed our conference. I think we're going to be fine going forward. Big 12, though, has lost Oklahoma, Texas, not the same conference. Do you just lock in things that frankly could change over the years? I mean, you've got to be careful about that. And change is constant, and I think it's important to recognize that.
Mike, we had started to talk about conference realignment, obviously a huge topic among the NCAA ever since the original Big East collapsed. Now, we know that losing Houston, UCF, and Cincinnati, a big hit for the AAC. What have you done to stabilize the AAC? And more importantly, what's the plan for the future?
You know, we recognize the fact that conference realignment has been a fact of life for decades, literally decades, going back 30, 40 years. And even prior to that, you know, you've had movement. These are voluntary organizations. If you pay your exit fee and you stay a particular amount of time, you can leave. And teams tend to leave for what they perceive as greener pastures. Texas and Oklahoma are leaving for the SEC. That created a domino effect. That's typically what happens. Usually conference realignment plays when these spasms occur, when these, you know, earthquakes occur. Things play out. There are aftershocks, and they play out over a period of maybe a year, even two. That's what happened back in 2010 all the way through 2012, which definitely affected the Big East. I was commissioner at the time, so I've been through this before. This isn't my first realignment rodeo, unfortunately, and I've been on both sides of it, and neither side of it is pleasant. But, you know, to make a long story short here, we basically have reconstituted, and we can talk about that if you'd like, but we reconstituted with six, we think, really good teams that have tremendous potential. And some have already realized, you know, some of that. Teams like UAB, UTSA is in the top, 25 right now. We've got teams that are in big markets that fit our philosophy. So we think that although we're losing three very good schools, the incumbent schools in our conference have been very competitive with the schools that are leaving. Now, these aren't dynasties that are leaving. We've had tremendous success against those schools, and they've been great for us, too. We feel that ultimately we help them by being a conference that has a great TV deal and great TV exposure. We help them build their brands, but they helped us, too, develop into a great conference. And I have no animosity toward them in leaving. You know, you cannot take this personally. It's not a personal thing.
Well, Mike, you know, I mean, my question for you is this. I mean, with the six new teams that are coming in, obviously, you know, it changes the talent pool that the American is going to basically be leaning on, right? And so for my question, you've been able to, despite all of the turnover, you know, in the AAC since it's really been formed, you know, players like Antonio Gibson, Quentin Grimes, you know, I mean, you've still been able to generate, you know, elite performers at the next level. And so, you know, my question for you is, how does that, you know, that talent pool that you're kind of, you know, accessing change, and how do you see that kind of evolving over the future?
Well, it's really going to be a factor of whether the teams coming in, you know, can elevate their game by virtue of the tremendous exposure we receive from ESPN. We have a great TV deal that helped build our brand. You know, we get ABC appearances. Memphis, when they went to the Cotton Bowl, appeared four times on ABC during that season back in 19. You know, UCF built its brand with all those great national appearances. Four times game day has come to our campuses. Think about that. Four times. If you had told me in 2013 when we were reconstituting that 5 years later or so, Memphis and SMU would play on national TV on ABC at night and game day would be in Memphis, you would have said, you know, what is this guy doing here? You know, the point is it did happen, and I think it'll happen again. We have brought in some really good teams. Now, we have had, you know, elite performers all along the way. I don't think that will necessarily change. One issue, though, is the transfer portal and the elimination of the year in residency for transfers. That's going to have an impact on everyone. I don't know how many players, you know, will lose as a result. I don't know how many players will gain as a result. SMU has built its team through better recruiting, but also through transfers because, you know, being in Dallas, you know, they get a lot of players who played in the area and then want to come home at some point, whether as grad transfers or as regular transfers. We typically concentrate on teams in big markets where there's also a real passion for football, which drives us. But we also want to be good in basketball. You know, we really do, and I think we will be. That's another factor. But I think we'll get, you know, we'll still get great talent coming to our schools, and I'm pleased that the teams that are coming in have made real investments and they're serious. If you don't make an investment, you're not going to get there. And we think that that's a hallmark of what this conference has been about.
Mike, just for the fans out there that are uninitiated, it's a 4-team playoff. They met in Dallas last week, and they're considering expanding to 8 and possibly 12. Can you just tell everybody how this thing works and how it plays out? They need a unanimous consent. Is that right?
Well, you need unanimous consent to expand within the current term, which ends after the 25 season. Okay. So in the earliest you can do it, Mike, is 24. So to expand the playoff in 24 and 25, you would need unanimous consent. Beyond that, I'm not sure what the process is going to be if when we negotiate a new deal.
Are you on that committee, Mike?
Yes.
Okay.
All 10 FBS commissioners are on the committee, and Jack Swarbrick from Notre Dame also is a voting member. We also have a board of managers, our presidents, who will ultimately have the final say. Each conference, that's on that committee, each of the 10 has a president on the board, and also Notre Dame's president. So that's the governing structure. And again, you need the unanimity during the current term if you want to change things. Beyond that, I'm not sure.
Mike, I want to get from you a sense of how NIL will help the AAC, your conference, and what you've seen so far in terms of impact.
You know, it's hard to judge and gauge the impact so far, Scarlett. We're in the incipient stages. Obviously, there have been deals done. I guess there have been plenty of them, but I don't know what impact they've had yet. We ultimately favored, loosening the restrictions and allowing, essentially student-athletes to capitalize on their name, image, and likeness. But, it's a double-edged sword. It creates some unintended consequences. You know, it's not supposed to affect recruiting, right? It's not supposed to be used as a recruiting tool. But it's really hard to imagine that it won't be, or hasn't been already. The Alabama quarterback hasn't played it down, gets endorsement deals of almost $1 million. Well, is that a recruiting issue? A donor at BYU, I guess a business person, decided to give every BYU walk-on the equivalent amount of money as to a scholarship. Well, does that violate our 85 scholarship restrictions? That's an important deal because, we thought that the scholarship limits have made college football much more competitive than it was, decades ago. And it's really created a tremendous amount of interest in college football. And all of a sudden, if you do something like that, now the NCAA, as based on that recent court case, has really been kind of shying away from a lot of these issues. And so the NCAA doesn't have the same impact. So NIL could be, we're going to have to monitor it pretty carefully. You can't roll back the ocean. I think student athletes will benefit. I think there are certain things they should have been able to do before that probably would have, forestalled where we've gotten to. I think we could have probably loosened the rules a while ago in some ways. But that's always the case. You can always say that.
Oh, come on, Mike. What's not to like about Georgia Tech football is wearing TiVo-branded pajamas. But no, from my perspective, the question is this. If you look back at the at the inception of the AAC, it was really driven by, the dichotomy between basketball and football and the amount of money, that was, TV rights and all that goes hand in hand with that. And, now that we have NIL, individual likeness, all of that stuff, wouldn't you think that maybe favors a pivot back toward the basketball player as opposed to the football player from a branding perspective? And how does that change the conference and, your focus going forward?
Well, Damian, it also shifts focus to Olympic sports, too, and especially women's sports. You have some outstanding women gymnasts. You have outstanding women's basketball players who obviously are probably, they may have more Twitter followers and may have more social media followers than a lot of the men. So, it's a gender equity too. This is an issue too. It helps women, obviously, capitalize on what they've done. And I think that's all good. and Olympic sports that don't get as much attention. And basketball, sure, you know, you'll see, you know, some high profile basketball players, and you have, you know, the rosters are smaller, so therefore there's more attention. But, you know, football's, you know, the sport that drives everything, and it drives the money, it drives realignment, it drives the TV deals. And so there'll be a lot of focus on the football stars who are, you know, getting the endorsement deals. And the real issue is, okay, can it be controlled to the point where it's just not being it's not just a way to pay players. It's not a way to just, you know, buy players and essentially recruit players by virtue of what, you know, the local business can offer them. That's really going to be the issue. And I don't know where it's going to go. Nobody knows at this point. I think we're to some degree in the Wild West, and we're trying to look for some the term is guardrails. I'm not sure I love that term, but the point is we're looking for some kind of limitations that don't hurt our student athletes' ability to monetize certain things. But you got to be careful too, because our fans going to get turned off if they see that, you know, there's less emphasis on the play on the field, on the name on the front of the jersey, that it's just all about the money. I hope it doesn't come to that. And I think that's what you have to worry about. And I don't like this. I don't want to see, our student athletes become employees. I just think that's not what college sports is about. I'm not sure fans would embrace that. But then again, I don't know. I mean, I'm not willing to make any predictions. I'm not a prophet, and I don't know how this is all going to play out. So far, it's had very, you know, I think minimal effect on how people are viewing the teams and how they view college sports. But down the road, that could change, especially as you get into squabbles about money and other things that maybe a lot of fans would find distasteful. So we're just not sure where it's going yet.
So, Mike, let me ask you about name, image, and likeness internally. Can it be a force that can divide a locker room? You know, Johnny gets a brand new car from Fred's car dealership, and the rest of the team has you know, cameos for $45.
You know, Mike, I think you probably could discuss that more intelligently than I could, because you've been there, you've been in that locker room. You know, I was in a high school locker room, and that's a little different. But even this is filtering down to the high schools, you know, and you know, some people might find that very disconcerting. You know, certainly it's a real concern. Kids giving up their senior year of high school in order to monetize, you know, their performances. I mean, those years can never be recaptured. And are those kids going to regret that, you know, not being, you know, able to have some of those experiences down the road, just to get a few bucks? I hope that isn't an issue. But yeah, in terms of the locker room, sure. We don't know yet. I mean, we don't know. What about performance? What if somebody's performance is slackening off, and people feel that maybe, you know, that particular player has been spending too much time doing endorsements or too much time doing this or that, or, you know, like you said, other guys don't have the endorsements that some have, and is there a built-in resentment? We don't know. There's just no way to know yet how that's going to affect locker rooms. And we'll just have to wait and see. So far, it seems to be the kids are all pulling together, and if somebody gets a nice endorsement, everybody seems, you know, happy for him or her. So we'll see what happens.
Lynchy, if they had NIL back in your day, how much do you think you could have made off that one kick against Yale?
You know, I didn't go home in the team bus, but I went home in the backseat of a friend of mine who was the hockey captain, and we pulled up to the Mass Turnpike to pay the 45-cent toll, and they said I was sitting in the back seat, and the guy waved the 45-cent toll. So
that's
probably the extent of it.
You know, that just shows where inflation's taken.
Yeah.
You know? What's that toll now? $10?
Yeah, it probably is. It probably is, Mike.
All right. Good stuff. Mike, we want to thank you for your time today. Mike Oresko is the commissioner of the American Athletic Conference, the AAC.
Scarlett, thank you. And Mike and Damian, really enjoyed being with you, and happy to do it again sometime.
Mike Oresko there with the AAC. And I have to confess that sometimes it throws me for a loop, AAC versus ACC. But then I remember that he used to head up the Big East. And you've got all these different names. The AAC, to me, doesn't really tell you what kinds of schools are in the conference, which makes the whole conference realignment discussion all the more interesting, that it's not immediately recognizable which schools are where and how they all come together.
That's a great point. I mean, 9 different states, and now with the 3 teams that are going to be leaving that conference, Scarlett, I mean, it's going to stay at 9 states, but you're swapping Ohio for Alabama, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of bit of transition. What's really interesting about the location, or shall I say the regional diversity of the league, is with NIL. You know, that's going to hit first at the state level, not at the national level. There's going to be like a federal policy that this, you know, basically lays down the foundation for what NIL is. So now now, you know, Mike has to deal with 9 different states, 9 different, true, you know, bodies of regulation. I mean, it's a lot to manage, a lot to unpeel there, I would think.
You know, I feel bad. His league is sort of like the Rodney Dangerfield of NCAA athletics. I mean, they've had teams that are deserving to get, for serious consideration in the playoffs, like University of Central Florida and this year Cincinnati. But as long as it remains at 4, the committee's going to go where the money is, and the money is with the Southeastern Conference teams and the Big Ten teams and the ACC teams. And until they open it up, teams like Cincinnati and University of Central Florida aren't going to have the opportunities.
My goal is to be the number one pick. That's something I've been dreaming of since a kid.
It feels better to be number one than number 5.
I wear the number because of Mike.
We have a chance to go for 3 in a row.
Good numbers at a good time.
When I first started wearing that number, I was just happy and proud.
Bloomberg Business of Sports, the number of the week.
Okay, let's turn to our number of the week. Michael Barr is not with us today. He will be back later, but I get to fill his slot, so yay. That means I won't lose. let's stay with football, because back in 1974, the NFL introduced a rule that called for a single period sudden death overtime for all games that had ended in a tie. So before this rule came into effect, a total of 258 regulation ties actually occurred from 1920 to 1973. Barr's not here, so we're going to give a shout out to Barr. Last weekend, Michael Barr's 0-8 Lions tied the 5-3 Steelers. The question is, since 1974, when this rule came into effect, how many NFL games have ended in a tie?
Well, let's just talk about that Steelers-Lions game. I mean, nobody wanted to win it, huh? I mean, it just kept going on and on. But my guess to that, all right, how many ties since 1974?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, 25, maybe?
Is that your final guess?
Yeah, yeah.
25?
Yeah. Mm.
Lynchy?
Well, I'm going to just try to weasel in on the prices right here. I'm going to go one above. I'm going to go 26.
Ooh.
Okay, 26 for Lynchy and 25 for Damian. Once again, Lynchy wins because the answer is 27.
Ooh.
How do you do this?
He's cheating.
Damien made the mistake of going first.
Yes. Actually, Damien, I wasn't going to tell you my trick, which is you always okay. Let Lynchy go first.
Okay. Well, yeah. the one interesting thing about it all is if you count all those ties before 1974, I mean, Lynchy, since you're pretty good at this, what team is that? Who has the most ties in NFL history going back to the beginning of time?
Well, I'm going to go with it. Have to be the Chicago
you
Bears.
You got it.
Yeah. Well done.
Well done.
Lynchy.
Well, I just think of what team's been around the longest. That was
process of elimination works well here. This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports Show. I'm Scarlett Fu on Twitter at Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Damian Sassauer on Twitter at DSassauer.
And I'm Mike Lynch. You can follow me at LynchyWCVB.
And tune in again next week for the latest on the stories moving big money in the world of sports. You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.